On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about how Comcast is doing their lobbying. Plus, we talk about how broadband is doing in rural America. Plus, Brian, Heather, and I talk with Cameron Crandall from Kingston about enterprise SSDs. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 343, recorded May 24th, 2019. Inoculate your bits. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Clear. Clear uses your eyes and fingertips instead of traditional ID documents to get you through security faster at airports and stadiums. For your first 2 months free, visit clearme.com/enterprise and enter promo code ENTERPRISE. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise class cloud storage at 1/5 the price of Amazon S3 and up to 6 times faster with no hidden fees for egress or API requests. Calculate your savings and try Wasabi with free unlimited storage for a month at wasabi.com and enter the code ENTERPRISE. And by Atlassian. Atlassian software powers the full spectrum of collaboration between IT teams and the rest of your organization. Visit Atlassian.com/IT to see what IT can be by giving their products a try for free. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need some help from some of the top enterprise tech professionals in the industry. I'm surrounded by them. Our very own, starting with our very own not Mr. Curtis Franklin. That's Mr. Brian G, our geek in paradise. G-Bird, it's always great to have you back, sir. What are you busy with?
Actually, I'm getting ready to do a special event this weekend for a very, very, very large insurance company providing Wi-Fi for 3,500 people. And sorry, Mo, it's not your brand.
That's okay. I don't get out of bed for 3,500 people.
That's what I was going to say. A person who's not shy to or not very familiar with supporting Wi-Fi for that amount of people, our very own Heather Williams, Senior Product Solutions Architect of Records Network. Heather, how have you been? We've missed you.
Thank you so much. I've missed you guys. And I have to apologize because as much fun as I made of Bam and Curtis about their con cough coming back, having acquired a virus at RSA, I did the same thing that I was at Nutanix a couple of weeks ago, and I came back with a pretty bad head cold. So I'm going to keep my fingers crossed since I'm going to be at the Palo Alto Ignite conference in a week. So maybe I'll go wearing a couple of extra masks or something.
That's what I was going to say. Hopefully your immune system is up to par for another conference once. Fantastic. Well, folks, we have an amazing show for today. Now we're talking about Comcast lobbying. Plus, we talk a little about broadband in rural America. But we have also a great guest, Cameron Crandall from Kingston, to talk about physical storage and the future of enterprise SSDs. But before we get into all that goodness, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. So open source software is sometimes really hard to sell to people that don't have much time or need or even being able to fund themselves with other jobs. But what if you could get paid for contributing? Would it basically change the model for you? Well, GitHub actually wants to see if they can change the status quo here. GitHub will soon debut their new program called Sponsors. Now, similar to Patreon, developers can offer various fund tiers that come with different perks. They can receive recurring payments from supporters for contributing. They also get, in order to get the program off the ground, GitHub is promising zero fees to use the program. It's covering both the payment processing costs for the first year, and it will also match sponsorship payments up to $5,000 per developer during the first year using the feature. I don't know about you, but the matching's pretty cool. Now, Another interesting feature is the ability for individual projects to be able to use sponsors to raise money as well. GitHub will even let a project link out to the funding pages on their websites or other websites like Patreon and OpenCollect do. Now, if you were on the fence to start contributing or you needed a bit of assistance or incentive to keep spending that time contributing, this might be it. GitHub might just be changing the open source game for good.
IoT versus BYOD, the apples and oranges of security risks. There's another article out today describing the risks that IoT devices pose to enterprise networks. A lot has been written about the quantity and quality of these, quote, consumer-grade, unquote, devices, and how they are proliferating not just in the home, but more and more on enterprise networks. Because many of these devices are employee-owned, there seems to be a need to compare IoT in the workplace to the proliferation of BYOD a decade ago, and the challenges IT and security teams faced with how to allow these devices access to company resources. The difference with security for BYOD devices is that although they too are consumer-grade, they are largely smartphones and tablets, and these are devices that get regular OS updates and patches, and they often require setting a unique login and password from the outset. Additionally, employers now have options for securely onboarding guest and BYOD devices, and many have even instituted policies that essentially mandate spyware before corporate resources can be accessed. In contrast, the attack surface provided by IoT devices is alarming. Researchers at Zscaler found that organizations in their study were running 270 different IoT device profiles from 153 different IoT manufacturers. These devices pumped out 56 million transactions over the course of a single month, and 90% of that traffic was in the clear over a plain text channel. Additionally, there's a high use of default and hard-coded passwords present in IoT devices, and malware payloads contain a list of known default username password combinations, which, among other things, enables one infected IoT device to infect another. The good news is that there's increasing awareness, and 46% of enterprises today say that enhancing IoT discovery, isolation, and access control is a top IoT priority in 2019. Now, about those cameras in the airline entertainment systems that are staring at you.
Well, let's go to the next scary topic. Okay, tenants in New York City just won the right to physical keys over smart locks from their landlords. The key to this story is that tenants do not want landlords to have the ability to electronically lock them out of their units, which would become all too easy with an electronic lock, not to mention how some landlords have also been using the electronic logs of these locks to do what is termed illegal surveillance. Quote, this is a huge victory for those tenants and tenants throughout New York City. These types of systems, which landlords have used to surveil, track, and intimidate tenants, have been used frequently in the city, said Michael Kozek, the attorney representing the tenants in Manhattan, said in a statement. These tenants refuse to accept the system and the negative impact it has had on their lives. Hopefully, they will be an inspiration for other tenants to fight back. Now, the story does stress this is not a court precedent, since the case was settled. But considering just how new this technology is, I'm sure someone is going to abuse them again and make sure renters can't have the convenience of unlocking their doors with a phone.
Now, you're probably not surprised that ransomware is on the rise. Well, for state and even local governments, it continues to grow as an issue. Now, based on recent security scans done by a public tool, reveals that a ton of public organizations have failed to do more than put a patch over common system vulnerabilities that, if successfully exploited, could bring their operations to a standstill. Now, if you remember, we covered the Robinhood ransomware, which infected the network of the Baltimore City set of computers 2 weeks ago. Even after that big blow that brought the city to a halt, the InfoSec group that was actually supporting that is still having trouble securing their infrastructure and software for even more vulnerabilities. Now, let's put it to some perspective here. Baltimore wasn't the only one to be hit with ransomware over the last one. Listen to this list. Lynn, Massachusetts, Cartersville, Georgia, both were hit with an electronic payment system which actually taken offline by ransomware this past month. Greenville, North Carolina was struck by the same Robinhood ransomware affected by Baltimore in April. But here's another eye-opener. Remember that SMB V1 vulnerability we found a couple of years ago now, public organizations still haven't actually plugged that hole. In fact, the Shodan search engine and other public sources have revealed that hundreds, if not thousands, of servers on the U.S. public school systems are still vulnerable to it. In fact, down the street from all the hubbub with Baltimore, the Baltimore County's public school system have 8 publicly accessible servers that still were running in configurations that indicated they were vulnerable to the Eternal Blue vulnerability, the Equation Group exploit exposed by Shadow Brokers back in April 2017. Now, this exploit is also used as part of WannaCry malware. Baltimore isn't the only city here with the problems, though. The Montebello Unified School District in Los Angeles has problems. Fresno Unified School District in Fresno, the Washington School of Information over in Washington State, Cupertino Union School District in San Jose, and the list goes on. It's 2 years since WannaCry. When is it time to actually start vaccinating and stop being vulnerable to the plague of exploits that can be prevented? If you or your organization haven't checked yet, you might want to go on that witch hunt to ensure your systems are secured and safe from the WannaCries of the world.
Ooh, snap. This story is to remind us that behind the products we use every day, there are people with access to our data. And while they may need access to do their jobs, without proper protections in place, those same people may abuse it to spy on users' private information or profiles. Just a few weeks after Facebook terminated yet another employee who as a member of the security team, was abusing his work-given data access to stalk women, Motherboard is reporting that Snap employees with privileged access to dedicated tools for accessing user data have used that to spy on Snapchat users. One of those internal tools, dubbed Snap Lion, is described by a former employee as the keys to the kingdom. Snap Lion is a play on the acronym LEO for law enforcement officers and was originally used to gather information on users in response to valid law enforcement requests, such as court orders or subpoenas. However, access to that tool has expanded to more general use within the company. Exposed user data includes location information, saved snaps, message metadata, and personal information such as phone numbers and email addresses. Snapchat has been fined by the FTC in the past for failing to disclose that the company collected, stored, and transmitted geolocation data. Sources for this story include multiple employees who were granted anonymity so they could speak candidly about internal Snap processes, as well as a cache of internal company emails. You'd think these guys would have learned from the White House the dangers of taking notes.
Anyone got a switchblade? Drones are now using missiles with knife warheads to take out single terrorist targets. With mainstream media bemoaning collateral damage from missiles, this Switchblade missile promises to limit collateral damage while still giving warfighters the ability to fight the war on terror. The Wall Street Journal reports that just such a weapon has been developed and deployed on at least 2 occasions based on information provided by multiple current and former defense and intelligence officials. Designated the Hellfire R9X, the missile has no explosive warhead. Instead, its payload is more than 100 pounds of metal, including long blades that deploy from the body of the missile just before impact. Quote, to the targeted person, it is as if a speeding anvil fell from the sky, according to the Wall Street Journal. Reminds me of Wile E. Coyote. Some official refer to the weapon as the Flying Ginsu because blades can cut through concrete, sheet metal, and other materials surrounding a target. Okay, a little gruesome, but while I applaud the effort to limit collateral damage, this just feels like a rocket-propelled spear from the Middle Ages.
So remember Instagram's previous data leaks? You probably do. Well, Facebook doesn't want you to, because remember they buried the leak announcement in previous blog posts that they updated that actually called out the Instagram leak about users' accounts and hundreds of millions of them being leaked. Well, Instagram is back in the news, and this time 49 million records were leaked. Now, this was due to an unprotected AWS or Amazon Web Service server containing personal information of millions of Instagram influencers, celebrities and brand accounts actually found online. Now, according to the security researcher Anurag Sen, the exposed data included users' bio data, profile pictures, the number of followers they have, their location by city and country, and contact information like the Instagram account's owner's email address and their phone number. Now, Anurag stated the leaky database actually belongs to a social media marketing firm called Chatterbox, which is based in the India state of Mumbai. Of course, Facebook is going on into an investigation mode here. They want to know why their partner Chatterbox wasn't securing their data very well. Well, my guess is they don't want people asking, well, why do they even have the data, Facebook? Well, Facebook properties are definitely a target lately. Even just a week ago, Facebook's messaging application WhatsApp revealed that it discovered a vulnerability in its network system that allowed hackers to install spyware via an infected WhatsApp voice call. The social messenger stated the spyware can exploit the mobile device, its calls, texts, and other data. And it can also activate the phone's camera, microphone, and it's able to perform other malicious activities. All that spyware did was actually caused a buffer overflow vulnerability in the WhatsApp VoIP stack, allowing for remote code execution via a specially crafted series of SRTCP packets sent to the target phone number. If by using social networking to share personal data, pictures, information about yourself or your family, your business or your life, and you think that data is secured because the company says it is, well, Facebook has shown that you might have false hopes there. Do yourself a favor, assume breach and walk it back to the living in the public and start securing your data truths today. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the bites, but before we do, we have to thank a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's Clear. Now, traveling is always stressful. I'm always stressed when I travel. I bet really you really enjoy walking into the airport and finding out that the line for the security line is so long that you're going to be late. And I bet you really enjoy standing in security lines waiting to actually pull all your stuff out of your bags and watch as people watch you do it. Well, let's reduce the stress for you. Clear helps reduce it for the best. Clear uses your eyes and fingertips instead of traditional ID documents to get you through security faster at airports and stadiums. Clear actually gets you through security with the tap of your finger so that you can get to the gate faster and reduce that pre-flight stress. Now, Clear replaces the need for physical ID cards because you're using your eyes and your fingertips to get through security, and it's basically your best ID there anyways. Well, now, with traveling, especially for your organization, time is definitely money, and spending time in security lines can have a significant impact on your own productivity. I know for me, I do meetings and customer calls. I do decision making while I wait for my flights. You can't do that while you're waiting security lines. Plus, if you're like me, you like to carry lots of gear into the airport and lose it. And sometimes you actually lose it when you have to take it out for security. Well, Clear makes it really easy. It's super easy to sign up. All you have to do is go in there and create your Clear account online before you go to the airport. And then once you get to the airport, a Clear ambassador helps you finish that process. In fact, it's actually super helpful. Plus, you kind of feel like royalty when they walk up to you in that busy public security line and walk you through the crowd, and then you get to kind of finish the process. And once you're finished that process, you're all set and you're ready to use Clear right away. Now, this is not only for business travel, I can promise you, but Clear also has family plans. And I can tell you, if you're traveling with family, you can really add up. In fact, I have 4 kids in my family. And in fact, if you have up to 3 adult family members, it's actually at a discounted rate. Plus, kids under 18 are free. And because I have 4 people that are actually under 18, that's really helpful. Clear helps you get through security faster at 40 plus airports and stadiums across the country, which actually more are being added every day. Now, if you want to save yourself time and money in the long run, and you want to make travel less stressful and more productive, Clear is for you. Right now, listeners of the show can get their first 2 months free by visiting clearme.com/enterprise and enter the promo code enterprise. That's clearme.com/enterprise with promo code enterprise for your free 2 months of Clear. We thank Clear for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time for the bites. Now, today we're talking a little bit more about Comcast, but this is an interesting one because Comcast is really kind of no stranger to lobbying. In fact, even in the Seattle area, they're able to keep out other ISPs in that area and providers by actually lobbying. In fact, the Seattle mayor seems to have a special place in his heart for Comcast wink, wink. In fact, Comcast spent over $30.3 million on lobbying in the federal level in 2017 and 2018. In fact, Comcast hired 241 lobbyists in 35 states in 2017. There's actually a site where they actually show some of their federal where their federal contributions go to, but unfortunately only shows up to the year 2017, which is really interesting. Now, you might wonder, what is Comcast's reasoning for putting so much time and effort into lobbying? Well, this is what they call it out for. For a company in highly regulated industries such as ours, providing information to legislators, regulators, and their respective staffs, and making sure they fully understand the implications of their policy decisions and a necessary cost of doing business, an extension of our right to petition our government. Well, however, there is a little to known fact maybe that Comcast also does this at the state level too, but doesn't really report it, which is actually really interesting. Now, at a recent shareholders meeting, which is actually the reason for this article, there was actually an investor called Friends Fiduciary. In fact, several other stakeholders have actually put out a proposal that they want to share at the shareholders meeting on June 6th. Now, this proposal, and now actually they're made up of over a million of votes here, so that's very interesting. Now, that proposal for this has been enacted, and it's supposed to make it so that Comcast has to disclose more of its state-level lobbying activity. Now, unfortunately, Friends Fiduciary has acknowledged that, well, its proposal is unlikely to pass, because it actually needs a majority vote, and the CEO actually holds 33% of the voting shares. But the shareholder resolution probably wouldn't even be non-binding, even if it did pass. But what they're trying to do here is they're trying to bring to the public that subject of the fact that Comcast should be doing the right thing here. They should be disclosing everything and any type of influence they're trying to have. Now, Friends Fiduciary also argue that Comcast secrecy around lobbying could contribute to the rise of municipal broadband networks that could actually compete against Comcast in the negative factor and cause their shares to be watered down. Now, Comcast faces strict rules for disclosing federal lobbying activity, but not at the state level. Now, I want to throw this over to you guys, for starting with Chibert. Chibert, do you think that do you think they're following this right? Or are they working around it in some way? Shouldn't they be disclosing more of this? I noticed that they're not even disclosing anything past 2017 here.
Okay, so let's put this in perspective. Comcast is evil. Okay, so now we've got that done. I personally think that if any organization, whether it's nonprofit or for profit, any organization that spends the kind of money that Comcast does on lobbying at the state and federal levels really needs to be upfront about it. I, for one, would really and truly like to know whose pocket my legislature is in, because realistically, I've gone out. I was actually on a committee. We worked really hard to break up the Hawaiian telephone monopoly a full year before the feds did. And I personally think, something that is a utility, something that is as ubiquitous as communications, needs to be more transparent. And personally, I think Comcast is the ultimate evil, trying to go and create the world that we saw in Blade Runner or THX 1138. Where our rights are being taken over by the corporate mega giants. Just my opinion, of course.
Right. Well, now the state and obviously state and other disclosures are often kind of a cursory thing or non-existent, meaning that investors have really no way of knowing what Comcast is spending at beyond that federal level. Now, the interesting thing, I want to throw this over to Heather. What do you think? Why do you think this is even allowed at the state level, that they should be maybe regulating this? Even some states have to, right? I mean, there has to be something out there, because, obviously competition fuels innovation and fair market value. But if you don't have it, if Comcast can just jump in there and spend a couple million bucks and get what they want, I guess I don't understand. What do you think?
I'd say they got their money's worth in that case. And to reiterate what Chibert said, let's remember that the push for broadband neutrality, and the reason why there was even any kind of an initiative to protect it, was because of directly because of actions that Comcast took. where essentially they said, well, there's no law that says we have to adhere to net neutrality, and so therefore we don't have to follow it. So I think they're being disingenuous by saying, well, first of all, anyone who tells me that it's too hard to tell where they're spending their money maybe needs a new CFO. I think that they're not reporting it because they don't have to, just the same way they decided to abuse the net neutrality law. And let's take a look at it on a broader scheme. We do know where they're spending their money on the federal side. And in Texas, they spend a significant amount of money on both of the senators in Texas. And I think they got their money's worth for that, because neither of those senators spoke up for broadband neutrality. And in fact, the state of Texas has one of the strictest regulations about community broadband. Some of the things that would be competing against entities like Comcast. So I'd say that they know exactly where they're spending the money, and that they know that they're getting good value for it.
Right. Now, the interesting spin here is around the investors. If you think about it, if I invested in Comcast, which I don't right now, but if let's say I'm an investor, I kind of want to know the margin between the profit and the cost of doing business, right? The operating cost. I want to know that margin. I want to know where it's at, because that margin kind of really means that the value of the stock could go up or down. So this is kind of the interesting part, is if they're not disclosing what they're spending money on, that cost of doing business, like if they say, hey, we have, you know, cost of doing business, here's our employee cost, but there's this black box of cost in here. We're not going to tell you what it was. It's kind of discouraging for investors. I'm surprised that this is not actually hurting their bottom line. But we'll see what happens. I want to last question over to Chibert really quick. Heather brought up an interesting topic here, net neutrality. You think with Comcast doing this and the ability to lobby, especially at the state level and at the level that they can do it at, is net neutrality doomed here?
God, I really hope not, but I'm really and truly feeling like this is the world, you know, Terrell Corporation and Blade Runner is taking over the world, and they can do whatever they want because they have more money than anyone else. Yeah, I'm pretty anti-Comcast, and I hate how they just try to keep buying their way out of doing what's right, and rant. I'm sorry. This has got my dander up about how horrible a corporation is treating the American public. And, you know, some folks in the chat room are saying Comcast needs to be broken up into teeny tiny little pieces and have done to them what AT&T got hit with. And maybe it's time, you know, maybe it really is time that the federal government steps in, but we know Ajit Pai is not going to do that. We know Congress isn't going to do that, because Congress has been bought and paid for. We certainly know.
Well, my senators have been.
Yeah, mine too.
Well, they have to consider broadband to be utility again to do that, right? I mean, they're not going to do it unless they consider broadband to be utility.
Yeah, and you know, President Trump's certainly not going to do it, because he's pro business. He wants business to be able to do anything they want. So I'm sorry. That's the end of my rant. I think we need to do something. I just don't know what.
All right. Well, let's put that one to bed. I think it's time. I think we have a little bit more interesting topic to talk about, and that's broadband in the rural areas. I'll throw it over to you, Mo.
Thanks. So the title of this AP article was, "With Billions to Spend, the Feds Are Unsure Who Lacks Broadband." I certainly will raise my hand over that. But nothing inspires confidence in your federal government as to say, having them tell you they just not quite sure. To put this in perspective, the rural the population of America that lives in rural counties is 20%. That's 1/5 of the population of the United States. That's 60 million people. And 25% of those guys are under the age of 18. So the story goes, is talking about that across rural America, the broadband gap that separates communities is growing leaps and bounds. The high-speed internet, which is basically a fundamental component of modern life. This is what builds small, medium businesses. It's what fuels those 25% of the kids that are going to school and trying to get an education. So there's a $4.5 billion federal grant program that was earmarked to expand wireless internet into these rural areas. And that was supposed to address this problem. But now it's on hold. And that's because the FCC was planning to allocate those grants by using coverage maps that were submitted by carriers. And the accuracy of these maps has been challenged by both lawmakers and trade groups, and the FCC has been forced to investigate. So, for example, in this story, they talk about a West Virginia city, Weston. According to these broadband maps, they call it a city, this town of 4,000 people is too well connected to qualify for a grant. Even though if you live in Weston, the problems are pretty obvious. You can't send emails from your phone. You get lost because Google Maps won't work. And even the FCC Commissioner Jessica Rosenworcel concedes that the agency doesn't know for sure where the needs are most acute and calls it embarrassing and shameful. Those are two accurate words for that problem. She goes on to say that our maps simply do not reflect the state of the deployment on the ground, and that's a problem. We have a digital divide in this country with millions of Americans who lack broadband where they live. And if we want to fix this gap and close this divide, we first need an honest accounting of high-speed service in every community across the country. So lawmakers were concerned about this flawed carrier-submitted maps that document both cell phone and home internet connectivity. And in February, a West Virginia senator, Joe Manchin, he joined 10 other senators in pushing the FCC for more accurate baselines. Interestingly, despite the large percentage of Texas that is rural, neither of those senators joined the request, although they do both receive significant donations from Comcast and other providers. I'm sure there's no coincidence. Disagreements over the data have led to wildly different figures on high-speed internet availability across the U.S. And a growing sense that the government just doesn't know. So on one end, the FCC says that there are more than 24 million people who lack access to broadband home. Remember, I just told you there's 60 million that live across the U.S. that are rural. But Microsoft says, who's been pushing their own approach to broadband rural areas, they found that 162 million Americans do not use internet at high speeds. And this is a problem that points to not just access, but the lack, not just availability, but the ability to pay for it as well. I can tell you that in my area, if you get in line for the 255 slots that Frontier offers, for at last count, $70 a month, you can get a 1 meg connection. And that doesn't even come close to being counted as a high speed connection. So complaints about the wireless map have poured into the FCC. And I really have to wonder how those complaints were delivered, given the crushing number of robocalls that are made every day. And the Rural Wireless Association, which is a trade group, asked the agency to investigate the data that was submitted by Verizon and T-Mobile specifically, suggesting that those companies had overstated coverage. And they, of course, have denied doing so. I was curious about this, so I pulled up the coverage maps for the two major carriers in my area, Verizon and AT&T. And if you look at the three counties that surround me, the LTE coverage, according to both Verizon and AT&T, is a solid bar of coverage of LTE from stem to stern. The reality on the ground is that we have oases of one bar of coverage in a desert of no signal. So people where I live literally get in their car to drive to cell coverage spots in order to. In fact, you can see a collection of people at the local gas station in the mornings because they're logging in and getting their email. So in February, I wish I was joking about that, guys. In February, Manchin, the senator from West Virginia, and other senators implored FCC Chairman Ajit Pai to use crowdsourced data and public feedback to create more accurate maps. And the whole process has been very frustrating for Manchin, who told the AP that as long as we continue to rely on carriers just telling us what they cover, we will never have a complete picture that depicts the real world experiences. So this entire $4.5 billion program is still on hold while the FCC has an ongoing investigation. So obviously, this is not the end of my TED rant here. We're going to continue, but I'd like to throw it to Chiebert. Should the Fed use money for things like pole attach fees so that the 5 gig microcells have a bigger bootstrap for rural and underserved areas? Do you think 5G is going to save the world?
That's actually a loaded question. Only because one of the stories that I'm actually following is most of the 5G is at a frequency that's the same that NOAA uses for their satellites to track water vapor in the air. And they're the number one reason why we get such great warning on storms hitting us. In fact, those beautiful maps where we see storms going across the country, those are all generated using a radio mapping, radio frequency mapping from NOAA satellites. And if you start putting a ton of 5G cells in, those create blind spots. Now, getting to the real topic, the reality is some sort of microcell technology needs to happen. And I think it might actually not be a true carrier. I think it's going to be something else. Like, for instance, we're going to start seeing something from your company, Ruckus, where we start having a new type of radio in certain things where you can create your own microcell. I don't think we're going to be able to depend upon carriers that are so hung up with the bottom line that the number of microcells to cover rural America is an obscene number of cells. I think it's going to be something else, and I think it's going to have to come from this grant program to get some of these things in place. And I think wireless internet service providers might be the answer. I personally think we will probably see a lot more activity in the WISP world if the federal government would use some of that money for low-interest loans so that people can start these WISPs to serve specifically underserved areas like rural America. So this is going to be really, really interesting. I really want to see what the federal government does. I'm just not holding my breath because blue in the face, Chibert, is not a pretty thing.
Well, that segues nicely into the next question that I had, and this is about how do we bootstrap WISPs. I think that a lot of people don't realize how thin the margins are for these companies, and they are essentially small to medium businesses, but the task is large. So the 20% of the U.S. population that lives in rural America actually is covering 97% of the land mass. So this is not an insignificant problem. However, I can't help but think that it's an easier problem to solve than the high density urban areas, where the problem is too much signal and really affordability. So do we do things to help bootstrap these WISPs and get funding for them so we can get them started? And I'm going to throw that question over to Lou. Do you have any idea how do we get not just rural areas but underserved areas? Because you're in much more of an urban area certainly than I am. What are the problems that those areas are facing?
You know, there's two parts to it. I think there's actually quite a bit of rural areas here, especially mountainous areas that are smaller population, 10,000 populated city, 10,000 people cities and smaller. And they all have this similar problem. As soon as you start going up the Cascades here, you lose connectivity. Going east, actually, to the other side of the state, Washington State, was actually a lot of farmland. You actually lose a lot of connectivity as well. But I think the biggest thing here is, going back to your question, is how do we get, these kind of municipal broadbands or WISPs kind of set up? And think of it like this. I think this would be an interesting topic to talk about later. But, we actually tried that in our little city that I live. I live up in the Snoqualmie Mountain area. And the interesting thing is we tried to bring it to the government to say, hey, it'd be great for us to set up and create a little bit more competition for broadband here in our town. And so by doing that, we can bootstrap the municipal broadband by just getting the infrastructure in place. So there's only a one-time cost. We get to move it forward, and then obviously we'll get a loan and move forward with the rest of it. The interesting part here is actually it can actually change the way elections work. Because if you go to a small town that needs more business, and it's actually their government that gives them the ability to go and set up these municipal broadbands easy, it could be almost an election type thing. It's, hey, we will vote for you if you go help us set this up. And so that could be a motivating factor, but they're going to need help from the federal government to do that. And I think there's a lot of times where this cost is just, you got to pay for it out of your own budget and that's it. There's no way to move it forward. And that's where things get halted. Just finding that initial capital to get the infrastructure in place to support it. So I'm just hoping that sooner or later there'll be some a little bit more or less ruling around, actually more rules around this to help support the small business to kind of get started. We'll have to see.
Or maybe fewer rules to inhibit some of that. As I pointed out, Texas and some other states have disincentives and regulations against community broadband efforts. And I know we've talked about that in the past. There's an initiative or a group, an organization called the Institute for Local Self-Reliance that I've talked about in the past that works to help communities set that up. As far as, and just in the interest of full disclosure, that rural WISP is how I solved my connectivity problem. And we did go out, find a WISP that was in the vicinity, and we basically paid them to put a tower up. I have about a 200 household neighborhood. And just getting that, we now have better internet connectivity in just this one little pod that I live in than the entire three counties surrounding us. And I think I could have gotten elected grand poobah at the by the time that our neighborhood got lit up. But there's a deep hunger for this and a big thirst. I'm not sure what the right answer is. I don't know how it is that we get a better map to the government so they can figure out who does and doesn't have good internet. But obviously relying on the carriers to report back has been of little to no use, as anyone who tries to find out where their LTE coverage knows. Okay, so that's it for my TED rant, and maybe you guys will let me do this again sometime. I'm all for competition and innovation, but I'm also out there for I believe that broadband internet access connectivity, this needs to be treated as a utility. We certainly wouldn't regulate against communities bringing their own electricity or running water. I don't know why it is that working against. Yes.
I got one last thing I want to add really, really fast. I want carriers to stop using computer-generated maps that ignore geography. I've looked at some of those maps, and they're generated by tools like ArcGIS, which is wonderful, but they're not taking into account geography. And that, I think, is one of the big problems.
For example, if you look at the lake that I live on, there's connectivity out in the middle of the lake. That's amazing.
Right. Before we get to our great guest, we have to thank a great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Wasabi, Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Now, we had Wasabi on last week as a guest, and you should go watch that episode because there's some amazing technology that Wasabi has and some amazing tools and services that they're offering. Now, I've used it. It's an amazing cloud storage service. It's less expensive than a lot of the other providers, and it has been able to excel in performance and reliability and reduce pricing. I mean, that's the key here. And in this day and age, it's really tough to actually support that. Now, from my experience, sometimes when you go down in pricing, you give up performance and reliability. Well, Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage has a way to fix all of these things. In fact, listen to the costs. $5.99 per terabyte per month. That's it. Plus, listen to the game changer, the pricing. They allow for unlimited egress fees. Normally, when you access your data, you pay for your data to access it. Or any of those API calls you make, those CRUD operations or data, you pay for it. With Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage, you don't pay for it. Plus, you're probably thinking, well, if it's cheaper and they offer better pricing, it must be slower, less reliable. Well, no, that's not true. Go back and watch our episode. But I'll tell you right now, they have some disruptive technology here. They have been able to have some proprietary way of pulling raw performance out of their storage devices without compromising anything. In fact, they have this process where they actually lay data on disks sequentially as opposed to blocks. Those are the traditional way of laying data on disks. And what happens is that Wasabi's actually storage is 80% cheaper, but 6 times faster than some of the leading experts and industry leaders there. Now, if you might think, oh, well, if they're cheaper, they probably offer less compliance, maybe. Well, Wasabi really has that covered too. They're both HIPAA, FINRA, CGIS compliant. In fact, storage is not really, whether it's fast or cheap, it's not worth much if it isn't secure. Well, Wasabi does that really well as well. They offer this unique feature called immutable buckets that really allows your data not to be deleted or altered, and it really just protects your valuable data from accidentally being removed or maliciously destroyed. Now, if you can go out and try to find a service that does that, that would be interesting. Plus, they add a 90-day rotating integrity check, as well as 11 nines in durability. Now, if you're worried about migrating to the cloud because you already have data on disk or on-premise, well, that's great because Wasabi actually has a solution for you there as well. They have the Wasabi Ball Transfer Appliance. It's powered by Netgear, and it's really designed to transfer large data sets and help you kind of reduce your cost there. Now, you might say, well, I already use cloud storage, or your organization probably may be storing data on-premise to save money or wants to be partially in the cloud. Well, Wasabi might have you rethinking those approaches, because I bet you want to go try it out right now, right? Because it's really fun to start building projects. Plus, it's really great to see how much performance and reliability you really can get out of your data from the cloud. Calculate your savings for yourself and start a free trial of unlimited storage for a month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, and enter the code ENTERPRISE. Join the movement and migrate your data to the cloud with confidence. Go to wasabi.com and make sure to use the offer code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Wasabi for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now my favorite part of the show. We get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Today we have Cameron Crandall, Enterprise SSD Product Manager at Kingston. Cameron, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lou. Thanks.
So, Cameron, our folks at home, they love to hear origin stories and people's journey through tech. So before we get into the whole hardware discussion, SSD discussion, can maybe tell the folks at home how you kind of your journey through the industry and how you made it to Kingston?
So sure, yeah. So I actually started at Kingston as a kid, so to speak. I've actually been with the company for 22 years. So I came in here at quite a young age and kind of developed my skill set from within. I've been on the storage side of Kingston's business the entire 22 years, which is somewhat amazing since we're mostly known for DRAM. And DRAM makes up about half of our business today. But I was on the storage track the entire time here. So I came into the storage industry when wide and narrow SCSI were in the marketplace, and 4 gigabyte, 3.5 inch hard drives were the mainstream enterprise class device. And Kingston got into the SSD business about 10 years ago, and we started developing SSDs for the client space and the consumer space, and that product line has grown, and we are now shipping about a couple million SSDs per month. We are one of the largest SSD manufacturers in the world, and we're taking the knowledge that we've learned in the client and consumer space now and going after the enterprise space. We have a lot of good enterprise customers that we've been selling DRAM and some SSDs to for many, many years. So we've got a nice customer base to go after. And so now we're going after or coming out with a enterprise SSD product line that is kind of more full-featured than it had been in the past. In the past, we've been typically have like one enterprise SSD that we were kind of going to market with. Now we're going to have 5 models before the end of the year. So looking forward to it. We definitely have our work cut out for us. But so far, we've launched 2 of those 5 drives this year, and things are going good, and we're looking forward to the next 3 launches.
Fantastic. Now, that word SCSI is sometimes a bad word in organizations these days. So that's pretty interesting to hear that you started that part of the business. But, you know, let's take a step back for a second. Let's talk a little bit about trends first. What, you know, you're talking about some of the new products you're coming into, but we're starting to see the fact that like NAND and SSD kind of, the prices kind of rose back in 2017 because there was a bunch of shortages due to demand. But then, like, I think it was midway through 2018, we started to see that shortage go away because there was less demand. And so then we actually saw some upticks in some of the 3D NAND factories come up. And so by doing that, the fact that people's smartphone delivery and buying smartphones started to go down. And so that oversupply situation kind of drove prices down a lot. Now we kind of fast forward to today, and now we're seeing the fact that prices are continually dropping here. Yep. Can you maybe kind of go through what we're seeing in trends and why we're seeing them?
Yeah, so exactly what you said. So the constrained market pretty much ended at the end of 2017. We've been in an oversupply market for a long time. There was a lot of pent-up demand. We were in the longest down cycle that I've been involved in. That down cycle ran about a year and a half. So I think there was a lot of pent-up demand. And one of the main things that was driving that reduction in output was the transition from two-dimensional flash to three-dimensional flash. That was a big leap for the semiconductors, and the yields coming off of the manufacturing lines were very, very low. So it took quite a while to get us to the point where we had a healthy NAND supply. And now the market today, even today, is flooded with NAND. And just like you said, that's why we're seeing the pricing continue to fall. We are very much in an oversupply market today. Not sure when it's going to level out. Some of the analysts are predicting maybe Q3 of this year. We're also seeing some analysts talking about this going, you know, well into 2020. But I think right now is still a good time to be buying SSDs, both on the client side as well as the enterprise side. I'm watching pricing every day, and it continues to fall. You can really get a lot of flash capacity today at a very, very low price point.
I think I was seeing there was the Kingston A1000 was like almost, it's an M2 solid state. You can almost get it for, I think, almost a terabyte for just $150. That's super impressive, I think, yep, for pricing.
Yeah, and we're about at price. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, go for it. Yeah.
So I one of the other things, you know, you mentioned the A1000, which is a M.2 NVMe SSD. We're pretty much at price parity now with SATA and NVMe in the client space, and we're really close in the data center as well. So while SATA's a legacy technology that kind of isn't continuing on with the next generation, there's for very long there's been a price gap between NVMe and SATA. And now today you can go out and buy an NVMe SSD, an A1000, at the same price point or in some cases lower than what you would pay for a serial ATA SSD. So you're basically getting 3 to 4 times the performance of SATA at the same price of SATA.
Right. Now, I saw some projections that it was saying that for the U.S., there's supposed to be data storage growth, from 56.6 billion in 2019 all the way up to 102 billion by 2024. So it's doubling within the next 5 years. Is that going to maybe change the trajectory of technology here? Is it going to be that, it's time to just phase out traditional disks and SATA and move forward and push the technology forward? What are you seeing here?
So a couple things. I think the transition to NVMe in the client space started quite some time ago. We know that the tier one PC OEMs NVMe shipments are well over 50% and actually into the 60% range. So we saw the transition from SATA to NVMe on the client space quite quickly. I would say where it somewhat stalled was in the data center. You kind of had the tier one hyperscalers, they went to NVMe very, very early. The all flash array vendors went to NVMe early, but there was still a large SATA SSD deployment into data centers, and there still is today. And one of the reasons we didn't see a big adoption of NVMe in the data center was cost. The cost of an enterprise SATA SSD in comparison to an enterprise NVMe SSD, there was a pretty healthy price gap between the two technologies. And the predictions have been for the last 2 years, 18 months, that in mid-2018, SATA and NVMe were going to be at price parity. That didn't quite happen. However, today, we are starting to see, in some cases, data center NVMe and SATA being offered to customers at the same price point. So again, it goes back to that argument or that sales proposition. You know, do you want to a drive that does 500 megabytes a second, or do you want a drive that does 3,000 megabytes a second at the same price point? So I think we're gonna. I think from here forward. And I've been watching this closely over the last couple of years. I think now we're really beginning to see the beginning stages of mass adoption of NVMe into the data center space. So, from a drive interface perspective, I think we're moving quickly in that direction. The other factor in all of this, in terms of capacity and price, that you were talking about. And starting to eat in more to the hard drive technology is the use of QLC NAND flash. This is where we're programming 4 bits per cell, which enables us to build very high capacity SSDs at a low price point. And QLC is really was built by the semis to really go after that cold storage market. There are still a tremendous amount of hard drives that are shipped into data centers. The largest data centers in the world are still consuming massive amounts of hard drives for cold storage. But QLC and the pricing that we're seeing even today, I think is going to begin to eat at that at that cold storage market, because it's huge. The semiconductors know it's big. The semiconductors and the third party SSD manufacturers, we've pretty much taken the client SSD space from the hard drive manufacturers. We've taken the high speed 15K performance hard drive segment, you know, from the hard drive manufacturers, and their last remaining stronghold is the cold storage market. And that's where the SSD industry kind of has its sights set. But we've heard from many big data centers that, until we're at price parity or nearly price parity with hard drives, they're not going to move to flash technology. So price is very key starting to begin to take over the cold storage hard drive market. So we'll need to be at price parity or within a penny or maybe a penny or two before we see some of these really large data centers move over to flash.
Makes sense. Thanks, Cameron. We're definitely going to come back. We're going to talk a little bit more about technology when we come back. But before we do, we have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's, of course, Atlassian. Now, like I said before, like whether you're an engineer, an IT team, or just want to manage a large team of work items, you probably have used an Atlassian product or two. Now, I remember back in 2002, Atlassian launched that perfectly timed product that meets that agile emerging market. Now, originally, it was conceived as just a bug tracking tool, but the Jira ticket really became that digital record of choice for tracking those units of work in that highly collaborative and agile environment that you had. Now, fast forward 16 years, DevOps is on everyone's docket, and Atlassian is still leading the pack in areas that helps teams rise to the occasion. Now, for me, I use Bitbucket. I've used it for many years. It manages all my project source code and documentation, plus tickets for those projects actually come through Jira, and I'm alerted on Microsoft Teams channels of that issue. Now, Atlassian really is a collaborative software company for that. It really empowers your IT teams around the world. Now, like all organizations, you want to ship faster, you want to ship more efficiently, you want to ship higher quality, right? Well, you want to ensure your customers' feedback is also kind of intermixed in there to get your business prop out of that. Now, sometimes businesses kind of fall short because they have these disjointed workflows, and that's where Atlassian's wheelhouse is. They give you and your organization the power to manage complex collaborations. Now, Atlassian provides that technology backbone to help modern IT organizations plan, service, and support all that change that really propels your business forward. Plus, their tools and services are not just for developers. Atlassian offers an affordable, reliable suite for all teams of all sizes, for DevOps to Agile, IT apps to Ops, ITSM, and whatever's next. Now, Atlassian provides the technology backbone, and they offer these great software packages like Jira Software, Confluence, Bitbucket. Atlassian forms the backbone of the effective and cross-team project collaboration, organization, and communication. With Jira Ops, Ops Genie, and StatusPage, they help teams really better detect those incidents, alert response teams, and coordinate those efforts, resolve issues faster, and they keep customers and stakeholders up to date. Your team can choose tools that are right for your current framework while trusting as you grow that Atlassian can grow with you. Like all Atlassian products, the tools for your IT team are easy and free to try. Just head over to Atlassian.com/IT to find out which Atlassian offering is right for your team. Now, try Atlassian today to see what IT can be. That's Atlassian.com/IT. And we thank Atlassian for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, let's get back to the topic at hand, and that's SSDs and storage. We're talking with Cameron Crandall, Enterprise SSD Product Manager at Kingston. Cameron, I want to talk a little bit about technology, and then I also want to bring my co-host back in too. Now, we're seeing, like you said, we're seeing a kind of a trend in the market a little bit, especially on SSD. But what about a little bit about embedded multimedia cards market? Is there change there as well? Obviously, more people are using cell phones. They're using, you know, other devices. Are we seeing a change in there at all?
I'm not really close to that product segment here at Kingston, but yeah, definitely. So we have an embedded group at Kingston where we're in a lot of, you know, wearable devices, a lot of home automation appliances, IoT devices, and the capabilities there with the technology that's available, where we're doing you know, multi-chip packages where we've got the controller, the NAND flash, and DRAM in a single chip. You know, we're making big strides there. It's a growing part of our business. But again, I'm not closely tied with those folks. But yeah, definitely have a lot happening in the embedded space as well.
Makes sense. Well, let's go back to SSD then. Like, are you seeing a bigger trend in something like maybe adding encryption to devices? Are you starting to see a big market for that?
So encryption is on all of our enterprise SSDs. To be honest with you, it's sort of a checkoff item for a lot of customers. I think encryption and security in the data center is handled largely via software and lockdown facilities. The actual implementation of using, you know, password protected SSDs in the data center doesn't really happen, but there is definitely a security component by having all of the data that's written to the flash encrypted. Even though that drive is wide open, if you connect it to a system, if you were trying to pull those chips off of an SSD and read them with a chip reader or some other method, that data would be encrypted. And the other aspect of that is when you're, you know, sanitizing your devices for redeployment, I think, you know, users and, you know, customers, storage architects, you know, I think when they delete data from an SSD, you know, they kind of wonder, is all the data gone? On an encrypted device, when you secure erase an SSD that does do encryption, it kicks out a new encryption key, which makes the previous data completely inaccessible. So definitely a value there with encrypted SSDs in the data center. However, you don't see typically password protected SSDs in large scale storage arrays.
So another question is, this kind of segues into my next question, is around some of your latest offerings, which is that the KC2000 SSD. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, why it's so revolutionary here?
So KC2000 is the follow-on to our KC1000. So this is a high-performance M.2 NVMe SSD. So it's Gen 3 by 4. The KC2000 will do TCG Opal. So we're doing encryption on this device, as well as it is manageable with third-party independent software provider software to be able to manage those devices locally or remotely. Most companies today, if they're deploying laptops, They're typically laying software encryption down on the drives and the systems before they're given to an employee. So if you can do that encryption in hardware, you've got a much faster device, faster deployment. But the TCG Opal component of that, which is the requirement to manage those systems remotely, is absolutely key, because a large company is not going to deploy, you know, 5, 10, 20,000 laptops and not have a management console to manage those systems. So we can't just give them an encrypted SSD without the ability to manage them. They've got to have that TCG Opal component, and the KC2000 has that.
Makes sense. I do want to bring my co-host back in. I want to start with Heather. Heather, you have a question about packaging.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask about trends and changes in the packaging of the devices.
Packaging in terms of the NAND or packaging?
Well, I know that that a lot of the SATA SSDs are mostly air now. So I was just wondering.
Air? Sorry, I didn't catch
like
it. Cut out
a lot of
second.
A lot of the packages, if you pop them open, they're empty. Well, almost empty. So the actual storage is maybe a quarter of the drive.
Oh, so like the advertised capacity versus what's actually usable?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's always going to be some so I think the question is the advertised capacity of the SSD what you actually see, let's say on a Windows machine, what you would see in the device manager or the computer manager software. There's always a little bit of capacity that's taken away for the file system. But in terms of you know, full capacity SSDs, like a 512 gigabyte or a 256 gigabyte, at Kingston, we're very keen on doing over-provisioning on SSDs. The over-provisioning makes an SSD last longer. It makes it more stable, more reliable. And so we'll take about, on client drives, we typically take about 7% of the total capacity of the drive. And we use that for the controller to do background operations to make the drive more efficient and more reliable in the long run.
Makes sense.
Anyway, I was going to jump in just because I'm big on, you know, sustainability. I'm starting to hear people talking about hard drive recycling because some of the rare earth elements are getting a lot harder to get. As this kind of trend started hitting you guys in the solid state world?
Not yet. I mean, there may be some suppliers out there that are, you know, trying to pull, you know, NAND chips off of devices and selling them in the broker market. But nothing that I've heard of. NAND today is so inexpensive. I can't see that happening, but I don't think there's a lot of rare metals in an SSD, but I'm sure they're harvested for whatever might be inside there that's of value.
So I do want to ask really quick, and then maybe if my co-host has some more questions, a little about the traditional hard drive market as well, and the kind of some of the new technologies that are coming up there and how they're kind of comparing. Like, for instance, we're hearing a little bit about the hermetically sealed or HE filled drives for traditional drives, as well as the RISC-V technology that we're hearing about, which is actually adding a RISC core to the drive. There's also the dual actuators, so allowing reads and writes to happen at the same time. Is this these types of things pushing companies like Kingston in the SSD market to change and move forward faster to make sure they keep up with technology and that kind of cost benefit that you have from traditional hard drives?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. You know, I think the hard drive manufacturers, as I was saying earlier, their last stronghold is the low cost capacity space. So if they can keep increasing the size of the hard drives and keeping that price point very low, then us in the SSD world, you know, we're constantly trying to catch up with them in terms of capacity and price ultimately. So as they continue to reach higher levels of capacity, you know, they're definitely extending their time in the market. I mean, the hard drive manufacturers are definitely concerned about SSD technology taking over their market. They've been hit hard on the client side. They've been hit hard on the high performance hard drive space. And they know that the semiconductors and the SSD community is really coming after that cold storage space. So, you know, as long as they can keep producing high capacity hard drives, it's extending, you know, their life in the market. You know, will hard drives completely go away in my lifetime? Probably not. But I think that the NAND flash technologies that are on the horizon with QLC, and the ability to put out a lot of NAND, you know, we're going to be able to make some big inroads into that cold storage market. And, so they're going to continue to try and make, you know, bigger hard drives, to keep the SSD market back.
So what about failure rate? I want to get into that a little bit, because then a lot of times, you know, these cloud storage companies, these big data centers, they have the traditional hard drives. They have to be able to swap disks in and out. They have to have physical people to go in and manage this kind of failure. Are we seeing newer technology in SSD, more failure, less failure, because of the cheaper price point? Or what are we seeing here? What's the trend?
Now, I think on the SSD side, the failure rates, you know, remain low. There was a study done at one time to really understand the actual failure rates of hard drives. And it was determined that the failure rates of hard drives were in about the 4 to 5% range, which is, as you know, is quite high. Where in contrast on the SSD front, it was determined that it was less than 1%. So, you know, hard drives have mechanical parts in them. As these drives get bigger and bigger, and the hard drive manufacturers have to do all these, you know, unique techniques, you know, to get the larger capacity out of the drives, and maintain the performance. I mean, I think reliability is definitely, you know, at a question there. You know, I know that there was a lot of development that went into rack systems that housed, you know, a 42U rack that housed, you know, hundreds of hard drives. There was a lot of technology put into these rack systems to limit vibration, because if there's any high levels of vibrations in a rack storage systems with hard drives of this size, the hard drive's retrying a lot to get the data it's trying to read. So, you know, those guys definitely have their challenges. I think that's where the reliability sits today. You know, I can tell you at Kingston, you know, our failure rate's less than 1% on SSDs today. I'm not entirely sure what it is in the hard drive space, but if I go back to that research that was done a few years ago, you know, if the big data centers can get away from hard drive technology, they will. But there is a price point at which they will switch over to flash, and we're just not quite there yet.
Makes sense. Well, Cameron, unfortunately, we're running low on time, but we do want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home where they can find Kingston, where can they find more about some of the enterprise offerings, where can they go to get started and kind of learn about those products?
Sure. So you can go to our website at www.kingston.com. You can go to our SSD section under enterprise, and that will take you to our enterprise line of SSDs. And you can look for more drives to be added to this segment in the next 3 months. And you can reach me at Cameron_Crandall@Kingston.com with any direct questions.
Fantastic. Cameron Crandall, thank you so much for being here. It was really great, some information. We'd love to have you back again. We love having Kingston on to talk about some of the next-gen stuff. So maybe in the coming quarters.
Absolutely. We'd love to come back.
Fantastic. Thanks a lot, Cameron. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Thing Enterprise podcast, according to 9 out of 10 3D TLC NANDs. But I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-hosts in crime, starting with our very own geek in paradise, Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, where can the folks at home find you and all of your work?
On Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or I'm Chibert at twit.tv. But better yet, why don't you use Twiet at twit.tv and hit all the guests? I would also like to encourage you to hang on after we close up the show, because we're going to have part two. We can't call it the after school specials. Someone pointed out that PBS owns that copyright, so we're going to have to change it to our second choice in titles, and that's called Chibert's Kitchen, where I cook up great topics for you to learn. And this time the next four episodes are going to be on VoIP troubleshooting. We did VoIP overview. Now we're going to go and start talking about the different symptoms and how to solve them. So they're short little bits, and it's going to be immediately following the show.
See, I thought that you were going to talk about Instapot, but that would be even better. Just kidding.
Love my Instapot.
I'm looking forward to both. Thanks, Gilbert. Of course, we have to thank our very own Mo Williams, Heather Williams. Heather, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, on Twitter, I'm at MoBetterWiFi. And if anybody's going to be in Austin the first week of June, look me up. I'll be at the Palo Alto Ignite Conference, serving as booth babe for Ruckus.
Fantastic. Definitely check that out. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You are our loyal listeners and our followers. You drop in each and every week to watch and listen to the show and get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to the show. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiet, where you'll find all of our amazing episodes, our back episodes, show notes, information about the guests and our co-hosts. But of course, again, next to those video links there, you'll see those helpful subscribe links to help you download your audio version of your choice, video version or HD video version of your choice, so you can help listen on any one of your devices. It's the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you subscribe, you should go ahead and share that with your friends, family, coworkers, whoever. I share it with my coworkers. They hear me next door during the show. They say, hey, what are you doing? I'm saying, hey, go subscribe to Twiet right now and get and find out more about what's going on in the enterprise. Now, of course, you're going to subscribe. You could always listen and watch live on Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on live.twit.tv. Of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you can always jump into our chat room live as well. That's irc.twit.tv. There we love working with the chat room. They have some really great characters in there, and they give you some really great content for each show. So go ahead and jump in there as well. Of course, remember, we also have a survey for you. Now, it focuses on how you use collaborative software at work. It's brief. It's short. Takes about 6 minutes. It doesn't collect any personal data anything. Just go to twit.to/survey14. That's it. It takes about 6 minutes, gives us some information about how you use collaborative software. Also, don't forget you can follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There you can see where I post about my daily work here at Microsoft. And of course, you can go to dev.office.com and see all the latest and greatest ways to extend Office and make it more productive for you. Also, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week of doing This Week in Enterprise Tech, and we definitely could not do it without them. I also want to thank all the engineers at Twit that make this show possible, and especially our co-host in crime and our producer, Mr. Brian T. Chi. He does all the bookings, the plannings, the show notes. We really appreciate all of his work. We couldn't do the show without him. And of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our TD for today, Victor. Victor, what was the topic of today's show?
I heard something about enterprise hard drives, and I also learned what gets Mo and Chibert going, like on rant. So
you found out how to push their buttons, huh?
Yeah. So,
I would say that's really close, really close. I would say it was Comcast is evil, but you were super close.
Well, that was what got the rant going, right?
Right. Well, maybe next time. Maybe you'll get it exactly next time. We'll see. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Good afternoon, good morning, or good evening, wherever you might be. This is Chiebert, and we're doing another of our Quiet Afternoon specials. So this is segment 2A. We're solving VoIP or unified communications drops and clipping problems this time. And again, this is Tim Titus with CTO of Pass Solutions. And we're going to take each segment in turn and dive into the most common problems you're going to start seeing if you're dealing with a VoIP infrastructure. So, Tim, let's dive in. What does a drop or a clipping problem actually sound like?
Well, a drop or clipping problem typically sound I'm missing phrases in it. So I think everyone's familiar with that sort of sound. That's what it sounds like. People get frustrated because you're only getting half of the words, missing words, words that are clipped off. And so that's something that I think everyone has encountered, because VoIP and UC drops and clipping, this is the number one problem that folks have in the world of VoIP.
And so, okay, what causes this kind of thing?
Most simply, packet loss. So networks have developed to be very able to handle a lot of packet loss. You can copy a file and say, gee, this file copy should take 10 seconds. If you drop 10% of the packets, it's going to take 11 seconds. Nobody cares. It'll retransmit and be just fine. You're dropping 10% packets on a voice phone call, it's going to sound horrible because you're missing one out of every 10 words, or every 10th word gets clipped. So people get very frustrated about packet loss in a real-time protocol environment like VoIP or video, whereas data, people don't care. And so that don't care historic has passed through to the point where now people have to care. You have to groom your network and solve the sources and causes of packet loss. Otherwise, you're just going to end up with call quality issues.
So, okay, that's cool. How do you find it? Are there tools within most VoIP systems? Are there third-party tools?
Uh-huh. Well, so most VoIP phone systems, they typically walk away from the network and say, hey, it's your problem. You got to find the problem in your network to solve it. So finding out where the packet loss is coming from, finding out why it's happening. And also the third thing that makes it really difficult is most of these packet loss problems are transient. That means that the problem will happen for a short period of time and then disappear. And probably by the time you end up going to look, by logging into switches, logging into routers, looking around the network, the problem's long gone and you'll never find it until it happens again. Which, if it happens again every hour, great, you might have a chance of finding it. If it happens once or twice a day, yeah, good luck in finding it. You're going to have to stumble across it randomly to actually say, hey, we caught it and we found it. It's on this interface and it's happening because of a bad cable.
Yeah, but I don't know about you, but it's always my boss calls me late at night saying, hey, Brian, my call yesterday at 7 p.m. really stank. Do something about it. How?
So let's go through the different causes as to where packet loss can come from. Typically, you have oversubscribed links with no QoS. Imagine if you had a 10 meg link going from Hawaii to San Francisco, and you were copying just massive virtual machines from one data center to another across that link. You're going to flood that link pretty quickly with these data packets. You try and get a voice call in there, you're going to be dropping a bunch of packets from the voice call. You're going to be dropping a bunch of packets from the data transfers. But again, the data transfers don't care. They're going to be retransmitted. The voice phone call, you can't retransmit the RTP packets. You're just going to have poor call quality. So if you have a link that is overutilized and you have no QoS, you're kind of at the mercy of what the network gives you. It's what's called best effort. And you don't want voice ever using best effort. The second thing that can cause packet loss, and second most likely place, is misconfigurations. Now, what type of misconfigurations can you have on a network? Well, the most simple one is a half duplex link or a duplex mismatch. Sadly, these still occur in a lot of networks. Just a couple weeks ago, I was looking at a company's network, and we found that they had a voice gateway that was running 100 meg half duplex. That's guaranteed to end up giving them call quality problems. And the good news is they were able to get it fixed pretty quickly. other misconfigurations, you can end up having a voice device associated with the wrong VLAN. If it has the wrong VLAN, you're not going to get the DSCP marking assigned to it. It's not going to be routing the same way as the other voice calls. So making sure that your voice traffic is all segregated onto its own VLAN is important to make sure it's just part of that voice protection that you've set up. Another place you can have packet loss is hardware failures. Number one is cabling faults. I think we've all heard about the person that said, gee, you know, we didn't realize we had cabling problems, and still we started looking at cable jackets, and they discovered that about half of their cabling was all Cat 3 patch cords that somebody found in a box somewhere and decided to reuse. Honestly, if you see a cable that has Cat 3 on the jacket, it's old enough, it ought to be tossed. And by the way, good practice whenever you toss a cable, cut both ends of the cable off. I've worked for companies before where you just throw a cable in the trash can. Somebody looks and says, oh, a perfectly good cable. They pick it up out of the trash can. They put it back into production, and your problems have just followed you back into the network. If you cut the ends off, then you can't have that happen.
Yeah, my favorite is, I don't know why telephone companies keep sending silver satin flat cables with their phones. I can't imagine anything worse than that.
Yeah, actually, that's a good point. Using the right type of cabling is important. Those silver satin, they should all have been retired long time ago. So if anyone uses them, it's like you're kind of asking for trouble as far as it's not following the Ethernet standard. Other hardware failures, you can have NIC failures. I think we've all encountered the switch that has a bad port on it. We've all encountered devices that have a bad Ethernet adapter on it. So there will be failures occasionally happen, and those failures can be the type where the entire network adapter fails. That's fine. You can typically deal with that and just say, let me use a new port. If the adapter half fails, and what I mean by half fails is you can have an Ethernet line driver on an Ethernet adapter end up not being able to have enough power to transmit the distances that you have set up. If you have 100 meters to your switch, you're really operating at the limitation of how far Ethernet can go. If a line driver fails and you're not transmitting at full power, it can't even do that distance. Other problems you can have that cause packet loss, you can have device resource limitations. Let's say you had a switch or a router didn't have enough memory. Or you have improperly assigned packet buffers. Imagine a switch or router that has gobs of memory, but there's only 5 buffered packets per interface. That means anything over those 5 packets, it has to discard. So depending upon how much buffering you've defined on interfaces, that can end up changing based upon the amount of resources inside of a device. But again, that number one reason for packet loss is those oversubscribed links with no QoS, and the misconfigurations that you encounter.
So, good tips. What I think everybody wants to know is, what kinds of things do I need to look for? So, what are my tools available to me to try and find and solve these bugs?
So, there's two real cases. There's being able to find it and being able to resolve it. So, on my slide 8. I have the ways that you use to find the problem. So typically finding the problem, what you're doing is you're looking to confirm that this problem does exist. Now, a call simulator or APM, application performance monitoring, you can use this to say, gee, we do see packet loss between A and B. You're able to confirm that there's packet loss. You can use a packet analyzer like Wireshark and confirm and say, yes, we are losing packets between A and B. You might have in your phone system the ability to analyze CDR records, call detail records, and say, yes, this call had packet loss between A and B. So this gives you the ability to confirm. And if a user says, hey, I had a poor quality call, you can say, yeah, my call simulator showed that you probably had a poor quality call too. My packet analyzer that was sniffing the call said, yeah, you had a poor quality call. The CDR record says, yes, you had a poor quality call. Confirming the problem is really only 10% of the problem. And so that's really where a lot of folks get stuck saying, how do I actually solve the problem? Because it could be anywhere between A and B. So let's roll into how do you resolve the problem. So with resolution in mind, what you need to resolve the problem is you need to pull out your network map and you need to identify every link, every switch, every router used between those two VoIP endpoints. Then you need to log into those switches and routers and check all of the interfaces for all of the error counters used along the path. You need to investigate the QoS configuration. So if we look at slide 4, what we can see here very quickly, so this is the path through the network that this call took. Looking at slide 6, what you need to do is investigate every one of these interfaces, every one of these devices, for all of the error counters, all of the CPU, memory, health on every one of these involved links, switches, and devices. Now, some people might think, well, wait, doesn't my monitoring software already track these error counters? Sadly, they don't.
That's a lot of spreadsheets, man.
Oh, yeah. Well, the problem is monitoring software will ping your switches and routers and tell you if they're up and down. They will tell you about link status. They'll give you some pretty utilization graphs, but they won't tell you about packet loss. In fact, the way to think about it is if you had a single half duplex interface along this path, could your monitoring software find it? And I would argue that most monitoring software packages don't have the ability to find a half duplex interface in a network. They're just not designed to look at that. They can't find a bad cable. They're not looking at the error counters. So as far as useful tools and being able to diagnose these problems, let's look at slide 10. And what slide 10 is going to show is if you had the right monitoring and the right capability, you'd be able to look into the interfaces, the switches, the routers, all of the error counters to be able to analyze what happened along this path so that you could say the bad call at noon that happened between these earlier in the day is we were dropping 8% of the packets out of the high priority queue on this one router. We had some carrier sense errors on this other router, and we had some collisions on this other router. You solve all three of those problems, your call quality problems disappear because you're now solving the root causes of the problems. So this is kind of the difference of why is it hard to solve the root cause of the problem? It's that monitoring software doesn't go deep enough, and you can look for this manually. You can build out your map, log into these switches, look at the interfaces, look at all of the error counters, and find the problem. Or you could look at software, I'll unabashedly admit, this is what our software is designed to do, is help make this easy to give you the root cause answer of these problems.
Right. And, you know, previously I've done an awful lot of spreadsheets where I have to pull down the errors if I even know where to look and then try to line them up on time. And that's a lot of work.
It is, but it's also that you have to know the error counters to pull, and you have to also know how to get the QoS stats off of the boxes, because you might have a Juniper router, a Cisco router. You can have a number of different devices, and being able to normalize all that data takes a bit of time. But I think if we go back to that slide 10, that's the difficulty, is that you've got so many places that you can have problems. And so many reasons at each of these places you can have problems, this is why it's difficult. And by the way, notice that this path is just one path. If you hang up the phone call and say, gee, that was terrible, and you make the phone call and it takes a different path through the network that's healthy, it might be a perfectly good phone call at that point. So this is what makes it so that people have a lot of challenges saying, well, sometimes it's bad, sometimes it's good, but it's that there's so many moving parts, it gets very challenging, and monitoring software doesn't go deep enough to answer what's really going on these link switches or routers.
Cool. You know, I've been using, I'll fess up, I've been using TotalView for quite a while, and it has certainly solved an awful lot of my problems.
Well, we've made it to solve problems for engineers because it's difficult.
Yeah, exactly. What kinds of other tools, you know, not everybody's going to be able to buy TotalView right now, but what kind of tools can we start using to help justify moving towards more advanced tools, I guess is the you know, the pathway we want to go? How do we justify to our boss?
So in one sense, I'm going to say you're always going to be good with Wireshark as a confirmation tool. It's going to be able to confirm that you're dropping packets. The problem then is finding out where those packets are being dropped and why. If you have a call simulator, that can help narrow it down sometimes to be able to simulate a phone call halfway across the network and say, let me test just this portion of the network and say, is it stable for half of the network? If it's stable, great. You now can rule that out and say it's not part of the problem. And so having good troubleshooting methodology of let's divide and conquer, find out, is the problem in our part of the network or is it in the carrier's part of the network? And if you say, gee, our part of the network is perfectly healthy, we've been able to validate, we have no problems in our switches, no problems in our routers, just by logging into them and looking at those interfaces, looking at those error counters, you can then say, okay, we've got confirmation that we're running clean. Then we want to end up doing some testing across the MPLS or testing across the carrier's network and validate and say, yes, the problem is in their network. And so that troubleshooting methodology should include a rule in of ruling in it's the carrier's problem and rule out of saying we can also confirm it's not our problem. Because sometimes you might be chasing two problems at the same time and not realize it.
Okay, so let's get down to brass. What kinds of best practices should our viewers be doing? You know, what kinds of documentation can we do to help the problem? You know, get away from the, let's ignore the cables for now, but, you know, what kinds of things should we be documenting?
Well, so best start point is have a good network diagram. Know your network. I mean, that know your network of what devices are plugged into what, how is your network connected? I can tell you the first thing as an IT director, when I came into a company, the first thing I would do is say, give me the network diagram. I need to understand this network from start to finish so that I know how it's connected. Once I knew how it's connected, I then logged into each device, each switch, each router, made sure that the logins were working, that I could get into the box, made sure that we had a good inventory of these devices so that we know what comprises our network. And if I found some old 3COM hub, I'd say, okay, that needs to be the first thing that gets off of this network because I don't want to deal with the collisions. The next thing beyond that is, as far as understanding your network, is make sure that you don't have any half duplex links. Seriously, half duplex should be gone from the network. Should have been gone 10 years ago. But it's sad as to how many networks still have a bunch of half duplex links or duplex mismatches that still cause problems for networks that people just don't know about. And if you knew where they were, you'd immediately go solve them and proudly say, I run a collision-free network.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many times we've had it might be perfectly fine gear, but sometimes different brands and different models of switches don't exactly play nice together. So I've had several instances where brand X and brand Y didn't negotiate correctly. And so sometimes we've actually had to go and hard set the duplex just to get around those. And that was one of the first things we did when we set up TotalView in my lab is like, I have that many half duplex devices.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear Neil Allen in my ear saying right now, if you hard set one side to be a full duplex, make sure, absolutely sure, you set the other side up to be hard coded full duplex. If you set one side to be full duplex and the other side to be auto, you are guaranteed to end up having a duplex mismatch. So when you go setting things hard, it has to be hard on one side, hard on the other side. Get rid of auto. The reason to get rid of auto is auto works in probably 95% of the time, but it's that 5% where it doesn't work, it creates problems. And that 5% is where you're going to have to hard set both ends of the conversation to be full duplex on both sides.
Yeah, my other favorite one is, there's a problem with the patch cable. We just patched it in randomly. Don't you just love that?
Yeah. In other words, they plugged it into the wrong VLAN. There's no QoS on that interface. All sorts of problems. They plugged it into a sniffer port. I mean, you can't just randomly choose a port and assume unless you're the one who built the network and you know all those ports are on the right VLAN. But you know, it'd be nice if somebody somewhere made a switch that actually showed the VLAN numbers that were associated with each switch on the front of the port. But I guess that would take too much space on the front.
Yeah, well, I tell you what we probably ought to do is go and summarize this segment. You know, what kinds of things, you know, what we know what it sounds like because it sounds like vowels or syllables are missing. Typically, we've got packet loss, maybe some out of order packets. Why don't we go and do a quick summary and maybe throw out some good resources for people that they might want to use to help with their network?
Okay. So again, clipping and drops, it's packet loss. It can also be out of order packets, but typically you're trying to find out where are these packets going missing. If you have QoS, enable it. There's many organizations, they don't have QoS enabled. Really, if you have any links that have any sort of bandwidth contention, even, you know, you're hitting 50% utilization on your WAN link, put QoS in place. It's going to help make voice a lot better. People think that, oh, I have gobs of bandwidth, I don't need QoS. Not necessarily. So QoS will be helpful in all those circumstances. And then just know your network, know where you're dropping the packets, know why you're dropping the packets. And then if you're interested in learning more about solving voice quality problems, you can go ahead and visit our website. We have some great blog entries, www.pathsolutions.com. And our blog talks all about how to solve call quality problems without buying our product. But it's really to help educate folks so that you can solve these sort of problems on your own. And if you need help, then you can reach out to us and we can offer some tools that will help make things easier.
You know, I think I'm going to throw out one more. I think it's document. You know, document your network because it's going to be that one switch that's off under someone's desk or something that's going to be your problem child. And if you don't know about it, it's going to bite you in the butt.
Yeah, yeah. I forgot about that, but you're right. It's the switch hidden under someone's desk is it's always the one causing the spanning tree loop or causing collisions in the network or just, oh, I just thought it'd be innocent to plug it in. And it's like, no, bad idea.
Yeah. Well, you know what? This was the segment 2A, solving VoIP and unified communications drops and clipping problems. Next time, well, the next one, we're going to go and start looking at how to solve echo problems in segment 2B. But this has been Chibert, Brian Chi. I am ADVNETLAB on Twitter and love to hear from you. And this has been a Twiat afternoon special on solving voice over IP problems.